to Wendell's World in Sports.
Let's be great. Let's be great.
An entertaining and provocative look into the world of sports and beyond.
Play our game. All right, play hard, but stay poised.
Please feel free to go over to Apple iTunes and rate and review. Your feedback is welcome.
Go rock this thing, huh? Love you, man. Go get it.
And now, the host of the program from the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, Wendell Wallace.
And welcome to Wendell's World in Sports. I'm your host, Wendell Wallace. So glad that you could be with us. A lot of things to discuss today, even though we're not going to be discussing things in the world of sports. I'm going to veer off just a little bit just for today. I'm going to be talking about some things, or I'm going to be talking about two of my historical heroes who died on this date, December 10th. One was killed in a plane crash. The other one was murdered. I'm speaking about the great, the legendary, my heroes, Otis Redding and Sam Cooke. When you talk about having dinner with someone, one of my favorite questions that's been asked of me is, if you could have dinner with one historical public figure or figures, who would it be and what would you ask him? And they would have to be deceased. And my answers are always the same. It would be Malcolm X, Otis Redding, Muhammad Ali, Sonny Liston, Len Bias, and Sam Cooke. In fact, you're speaking about, as soon as I get to heaven, if I'm lucky enough to get to heaven, whether it be in 2 seconds or 2 decades, whenever my time is up on this planet and I move on up to the greater land, if I'm lucky enough to be entered into the pearly gates, the first thing I'm going to do, I've always said, is to reunite with my dad, and by that time reunite with my mom, and go ahead for the first time meet my grandparents on both sides and get reunited with my Uncle Frank and my Uncle John and Aunt Odessa and all of them. But after I reunite and get back with my immediate family and family and say what's up to Stu Levy, who's up there in heaven right now, say what's up to Hayden Witter, who's up there right now, some childhood friends of mine, Cliff Glover, who's no longer around. Once I get past all of that, you know what, I got, and once I get up there, I'll have plenty of time. It ain't like I'm going anywhere. I'm going to be there for, my spirit is going to be there forever, so I'll have plenty of time. Time ain't going to be the issue. Once I get through all of that, reconnect, reunite, because it will feel so good, I want to just start saying, hey, you know what? Is there any way humanly possible, or of course, not humanly, because spiritually possible, that, you know, tomorrow I could have 15, 20 minutes with Malcolm, then maybe later on go to an Otis Redding concert and meet him, go to a Holly fight and meet him, go to Sonny Liston. In fact, is Sonny Liston in heaven? He is? Wow, ain't that something? Maybe go see a concert with Sam Cooke and just sit and just ask these guys, just talk to these guys. I would just love to just have them over for dinner, man, and just see what's up with those guys. And if I had Malcolm X, if I had the great, the honorable, the fantastic, one of the greatest historical figures of the 20th century, Malcolm X, sitting at my dinner table or in a position where I could ask him questions, first of all, I would say thank you very much for everything that you did, not just for the black community, but society and the world in general. And also, you know what, when I was living on Earth, and I was up there talking about the ills and defects of the black community and what we needed to do to get better and giving my thoughts and opinions about that, I was always just going to be asking you, man, what did you think looking down from above and taking a look at the planet that was, that we were inhibiting at the time, as you were looking up, you and Malcolm and Medgar and everybody else from the civil rights movement who gave their lives? And did you ever ask, did you ever like turn to Martin and when you saw something like Love and Hip Hop or any of these other clown shows or anything that was going on in our community, the black-on-black crime, the absentee fatherism and all those type of things in our community, the shootings and everything, did you ever turn to Martin and say, damn, you know what? We died for this? I just wanted to get your thoughts and feelings about what was happening. If I was up there and I was talking to Otis, or excuse me, when I was talking to Malcolm, I would love to ask him those things. Also, I would love to ask Malcolm, you and Martin, have you guys kind of sat down and philosophy, you know, kind of talked it over and what's your philosophy and what's his philosophy and maybe come to a better understanding and that type of thing? Did you ever patch up your relationship with Jackie Robinson? Because I know Malcolm and Jackie Robinson had a terse relationship because of their different opinions when it comes to bettering folks from my community. So those are the type of questions I would be asking Malcolm. And when are you going to be speaking again? And some of the issues that's going on in heaven. You know, are you going to be taking the Lord to task because, I don't know, maybe there's some issue that you want to take up with him and maybe bringing Malcolm and, or excuse me, bringing Martin and maybe, you know, Betty Shabazz and all those type of folks. So those are the things I would be asking Malcolm. And if I would had an opportunity to talk to Muhammad, first of all, I would ask him, did you make peace with Joe Frazier? And how many fights have you had since Joe has been in heaven or since you went to heaven? And of all the fights that you've had up in heaven, who's won? I would ask him, when are you ever going to fight Joe Lewis? Don't worry about it. Your spirit is never going to get old. Your spirit is never going to lose its hand speed. You'll always be able to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee up here in heaven. So when are you going to be facing Joe Lewis? Because that's going to be the fight, the greatest fight ever, bar none. And after that, are you going to be fighting Jack Johnson, the first Muhammad Ali, in terms of the impact that he had on society as being a black man, and Jack Johnson being the first black heavyweight of all time? So I would love to ask Ali that. If I had the opportunity to ask Sonny Liston anything, first of all, I would apologize. If I knew Sonny Liston was in heaven, first of all, I would then apologize. I would be kind of surprised, like, wow, you made it to heaven? After everything I read about you, you made it up to the pearly gates, huh? Well, shoot, In that case, I would like to apologize on behalf of the human race during that time for the way that they treated you. And, of course, I would like to ask Sonny exactly what really did happen the night or day when you died. In fact, when did you die? Because Geraldine didn't find your body. Geraldine is his wife. Geraldine didn't find your body until January 5th when she came home from visiting friends and family in St. Louis over on Ottawa Drive. She came back to Vegas, drove up to Ottawa Drive and walked in and smelled something foul. And she was like, damn, looks like Sonny must have left something, must have cooked something and let it spoil and let it sit on the table and let it sit in the kitchen because it smells awful. So she walks upstairs and she sees her bloated, dead husband on the bed. So I wanted to ask exactly what happened, who did it? Don't you think? I would just like to know that from Sonny's standpoint. So that's one of the things I would ask with Sonny Liston and Otis Redding. How many songs have you written since you've been reunited with Johnny Jenkins, Al Jackson Jr., Duck Dunn, Isaac Hayes, Wayne Jackson, Andrew Love? Those were all of the recording stars with Stax that Otis performed all of his greatest work with. And have you gotten an opportunity to sing with Aretha? Have you collaborated with Ray Charles? Have you collaborated with Aretha now that she's in heaven? Have you collaborated with anybody else? Any other of your heroes? Have you got put something down? Do you got something that's going to be funky? Do you got something that's going to be new? Have you evolved in the 50-something years since you've been up here in heaven? I would love to ask him that question. And I would also like to ask him, hey, man, if you didn't die that day in Lake Monona, the plane going down, 1967, December 10th, where were you going? Because I heard all this stuff, or I read all this stuff about you were going to leave Stax and you were going to start having a recording studio at your home in Round Oak, Georgia, and you were going to be recording folks. You were going to try to see what you can do to bring Arthur Connolly's music up to another level. So what exactly were you going to be doing with that? And the last but not least, I would ask Sam Cooke if I had the opportunity, man, what the fuck were you thinking about on the night of December 10th or the morning of December 11th, 1964? Man, what the hell was going through your mind picking up that bitch, driving her down to a $3 a night hotel in East LA and doing what you were going to try to do and then break into that woman, Bertha Franklin's room and doing all that kind of stuff? What was up with that, man? What were you thinking about? And I guess Sam's response would have been, well, that's the problem, Wendell. I wasn't thinking. I was drunk. I was fucked up. I was angry. I was upset. The bitch sold my money. And, well, you see what happened. But luckily, through my good deeds and through my earthly good deeds that I did, I got the pass. I got the membership. So those are the things that I would ask. I've always been intrigued and fascinated with public figures that have tragedy in their lives, especially when it comes to artists and when it comes to athletes, whether it's Andreas Escobar or Joe Delaney, the running back for the Kansas City Chiefs, who drowned trying to save three kids from drowning in the offseason back in 1983 when he was a running back with the Kansas City Chiefs. And during the offseason, he was sitting back, relaxing, chilling at a park, and he saw three kids that were drowning and no one was helping them. So even though he couldn't swim, he ran into this creek or to the pond or whatever it was to try to save them. And two of them didn't make it. One of them did. One of them now has been in and out of jail for selling cocaine. But Joe Delaney died. So there's always been stuff like that. Roberto Clemente, Lyman Bostock, I've always been interested in just the way they lived and just the way they died. And when you're speaking about, say, for instance, artists, other than Sam and other than Otis, I've always been interested in guys like Johnny Ace, who accidentally shot himself at the age of 25. He was an R&B singer with a string of hit singles in the 1950s. Now, the story is, if I could just digress for just a quick second, the story with Johnny Ace, I suggest you look it up because it is an interesting story. The story with Johnny Ace was that he was playing Russian roulette on Christmas Day in the Houston Auditorium right before a gig. Well, the story is, and this was told by a guy named Curtis Tillman, who was the bass player for Big Mama Thornton, who witnessed the event. Basically, he was drunk, and he was, you know, having a gun and being drunk are never a good thing, but basically he had this little pistol in his hand, and he was swinging it around, he was waving it around, and he was pointing at people, and people were freaking out. They were like, "Hey, man, Johnny, whoa, what the fuck are you doing, man? Put that thing away. Are you nuts? You're drunk, you're swinging that thing around, you're pointing that thing at me. I'm not looking to get shot." And Johnny was like, "Hey, man, it's okay. See, the gun's not even loaded, see?" And then he pointed the gun to his head with a smile and said, "Bang." So, you know, that was it. That was it for Johnny Ace. And Big Mama ran out of the dressing room yelling, "Johnny Ace just killed himself." So, for those who don't know, Big Mama Thornton was the one who's saying, "You ain't nothing but a hound dog. You ain't nothing but a hound dog," which is a lot funkier and a lot better than Elvis Presley's rendition by a country mile. But, you know, stuff like that. The Day the Music Died, where they talk about Buddy Holly and Richie Valens. Those guys, I mean, just stories like that have always, Marvin Gaye, has always just intrigued me. Has always just captivated my attention. So, and then with Otis Redding and Sam Cooke, just based on when I first heard their music, I was like, "Wow, this guy was really great." I was young, and it was like, "Wow, this guy's really great. What happened to him? What's going on? What's he doing now?" And, you know, my parents had to explain, or my dad had to explain that, well, you know, one died in a plane crash, the other one died after he was shot. That kind of automatically captured my attention, and because at that time, we didn't have the internet. At that time, we didn't have Wikipedia. At that time, we didn't have YouTube. At that time, we didn't have cable. I actually had to do some real research, like go to the library and actually read the stuff. And when I did, I just really became captivated. And throughout the years, I wanted to learn more and more and more about them. And I did. And now I consider myself somewhat of a pseudo-expert when it comes to the life, the legacy of both Otis Redding and Sam Cooke. Not saying that I'm a true expert, but I think that I'm educated enough to give you a really good explanation on why I think December 10th, we talk about John Lennon, people gathering in New York City to honor the life of John Lennon, because he was shot by Mark David Chapman. Another story, another thing that I'm interested about, John Lennon, his story and how he was murdered. But every year, the date of his murder, people come out to New York City and go to the park or Strawberry Fields or something like that, and they honor his death. And I just say that, well, if we can recognize John Lennon, then we most definitely can go ahead and celebrate and talk about and remember the dates of December 10th or 11th, the day that Otis Redding and Sam Cooke lost their life. Because when it comes to the overall importance of our society, when it comes to the overall impact, that if you take a look at the three, Otis Redding, John Lennon, and Sam Cooke, and when you take a look at the impact that those guys made, not just on music, but also on society in general, Otis Redding and Sam Cooke dwarf the accomplishments and the importance of what the United States is all about today and how we are a better society for it, because we improved, how we improved on our society. I've always said this before. You know, when we talk about, we try to minimize it. I've always been one of these proponents to say that in the U.S. history class, I'm a U.S. history buff. And when we talk about the history of this country, the fact that we don't mention historical figures that played sports is a crime, it's a disservice. Not just playing sports, but also in the entertainment field, whether it be actors or whether it be musicians, other than, I always felt that would be a disservice, because I've always mentioned this, you know, you can put a law, lawmakers can make laws, Supreme Court judges can pass laws, and politics and Congress and all these political folks, they can always pass laws. But for that, those laws to really be enacted, for those laws really to take shape, and for those laws to really mean something, it means the people are going to have to be the ones to embrace the laws that are being sent down to us. And if you are a part of the majority, and because of that, you're looking by law or through law to give up a little bit of control, to give a little bit of the piece of the American pie and give it to a certain group of people that you might not feel deserve that piece of the pie, whether back then it would be women, whether back then it would be blacks, even today is still a large part black, while it's now Hispanics, while it's now Muslims and those of Arab descent, while it's now those of homosexuality. The problems of back then are still relevant today, but because of the contributions, because of the impact that Otis Redding and Sam Cooke had on the society back in the 50s and back in the 60s, we are further advanced in the long than where we were back then. And it wasn't because of the Civil Rights Bill. It wasn't because of a bill that was being passed. As the great Malcolm X said, you know what, back in 1957, there was a desegregation bill that was passed. And for New York City, the bill was that all schools had to be integrated in a certain amount of time. And as Malcolm pointed out, that was a law that was sent down from the Supreme Court. 5, 6, 7 years had passed, no desegregated schools. The schools remained segregated. And the only thing that's being talked about with that bill is, oh, we're getting to it. Oh, we're getting to it. Oh, we're getting to it. So just because you enact a law, just because you propose a law, just because a law becomes part of the American fabric, that doesn't mean that that law is enacted. That law doesn't mean that all of a sudden now this society is ready to embrace that law. Well, you need people on the ground. You need folks like Martin. You need folks like Medgar. You need folks like those in the Civil Rights Movement. You need folks like Malcolm X. And you needed folks like Jim Brown. You needed folks like Jackie Robinson. You needed folks like Joe Lewis. You needed folks like Sam Cooke. You needed folks like Ray Charles. You needed folks like Aretha Franklin. And you needed folks like Sam Cooke and Otis Redding to educate and to make it all right for those who might be oppressing those who are trying to reach the status of equality and freedom and everything that America stands for. You needed those folks. You needed the people like Sam and Otis to go ahead through their music, through their actions, through their courage to make it possible for blind eyes to be able to see, for closed minds to be open, for rationale to take over, for the opportunity through example for those who might be oppressing to take a look and say, you know what, I was wrong. My thought pattern was wrong. My thoughts and feelings were wrong. My opinions were wrong about these people. And now having the ability through the heart, through character, not by law, not because someone says so, because you want to give them a piece of the pie. And Otis and Sam Cooke absolutely did those things. So December 10th for me is always a huge, huge deal. And I tell you one thing again, if I was a guy who was teaching full time and I had the opportunity, yes, I would be teaching a class where, guess what? People would know, the younger generation would know, the 14 to 18 year olds would know who Sam Cooke was and what his contribution was to society and why his contribution was so welcome and was so needed. The same thing along with Otis Redding. And I would go even further to include such luminaries in the music industry and as a Ray Charles and a Louis Jordan and a Mahalia Jackson and all those type of things. So I think it's very, very important that those guys go ahead and be recognized for the brilliance and the impact what they did. You can ask any of my friends, man. I'm a Otis Redding fanatic. If you even mention the name Otis, it doesn't even have to be Redding. It could be my friend Otis Sicily, and I'm just going to be going on and on and on about Otis Redding. I just love the guy. Love the thing. Love everything that he stood for. Because one of the main impacts of Otis was the fact that this was a man who was born September 9th, 1941 in Georgia. And as we know at that time, here in the United States, that at that time, the segregation, the second-class citizenship, the legalization of being treated less than equal, being treated like cattle, being treated like property was not too far from the slaving days, especially when you're talking about the South where Otis Redding grew up. Well, the thing that really captivated me about the Otis Redding story was the fact that he made his fame, he made his name with the help of, through integration, through working with white folks, through working with white folks, but yet and still being true to who he was. He was a guy, when he went to Stax Studio, you're talking about the Booker T and the MGs, four of my heroes were Duck Dunn, Steve Cropper, Al Jackson Jr., and Booker T. Jones, two black, two white musicians. And here were these two guys, when we're speaking about Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper, up here playing black people's music, and they were white. But yet, because of the influence that people like Sam Cooke and Otis Redding had on these guys, they were willing to work together in Memphis, Tennessee during that time, for all sakes and purposes, man. Memphis, Tennessee at the time was so doggone segregated. I remember listening to a program about Otis Redding and the black preacher coming to Memphis and talking about, man, that was unbelievable. Everything during that time in Memphis was segregated. The graveyards were segregated. I mean, they wouldn't even let dead people who were black and white be in the same cemetery. And the guy made it great. It's not like they're going to be bothering anybody. They're all dead. They ain't going to be, you have to worry about them integrated and having mixed kids and doing all that kind of stuff. They're dead. But yet, the racism, the segregation, of course, this being Memphis, Tennessee, was so strong that nothing was integrated in Memphis. But yet, here you have this studio, Stax Studio, where you had blacks and whites working together, bringing up funky, funky soul music, not pop tunes, not watered down rock and roll nonsense, none of that bullshit. We're talking about white guys like Duck Dunn and Andrew and Wayne Jackson, the trumpeter, who played horns on a lot of the music by Otis Redding and Sam and Dave and Eddie Floyd and all Carla Thomas and Rufus Thomas and William Bell, all of these great black musicians and great black artists that came into Stax. Otis Redding being the bell cow. He was the main man who came in there, really put Stax on the map. But this was a situation where it was just unbelievable. People would come in from out of town, whether it be Jerry Wexler from Atlantic or whether it be anybody else, and they would walk into the studio. First, they'd be sitting there talking about, damn, Memphis sure is a segregated city. But then they would walk into the studio and they would see these four guys up here at the house band, Booker T and the MGs, playing this funky, funky soul music, and two of them would be white. And that would blow their mind. And that never happened before. Never happened before. And it didn't happen in New York City. It didn't happen in Chicago, Illinois. It didn't happen in Washington, D.C. It happened down south in Memphis, Tennessee. A state below, they were bombing churches. A state below, the Klan and the law enforcement were hand in hand. It was, they were a state below and lived in a state where you could lynch somebody knowing that the town folks, knowing that the police department, knowing that those in authority would let you get away with it. Just ask Emmett Till and such. See, and here you go to Memphis, Tennessee, and you have these, and you have this integrated band playing this funky, funky music, and Otis Redding, that's what he walked into. And when Otis Redding got his start, he had to rely on, he didn't rely on, but he formed a partnership with the Walden brothers, Phil and Alan Walden, along with their father, C.B. Walden, who, speaking of their father, C.B., was an ardent racist, had no, at the beginning of the relationship, or when Phil and Alan were growing up, talking about their father, no problem whatsoever walking around talking about nigger this, nigger that, these niggers, that nigger, those niggers. Hey, Alan and Phil were talking about, yeah, my father was a hardcore racist. Otis Redding, he met Otis Redding, his charm, his education, his intelligence. CB did a 180. He went from being just an ardent racist to all of a sudden now helping black artists in the entertainment field get to where they wanted to go because of the relationship that he formed with Otis Redding and the business ventures that he undertook with Otis and Phil and Alan. It's a remarkable story. It's an unbelievable story. It's a doggone fucking shame that we haven't been able to put that on the screen. It's a doggone flipping shame that Hollywood, and maybe, you know what, the fact that when Hollywood touches something, it kind of messes it up, so maybe they should leave it alone, but I don't understand how that's not a Hollywood movie right there. Because, again, you're talking about something that was so segregated, the only thing that was integrated in Memphis, Tennessee during that time was Stax Studios, and the main guy for that was Otis Redding. Even an interesting story. Jim Stewart, who was the white guy, bought the property, turned it into it was over a 926 East Macklemore, turned it into a recording studio in the black community. And of course, those in his community, outside of the black community, when he would go to work, would be up there talking about, damn, Jim, why are you going to be hanging around those niggers in that nigger neighborhood and all this kind of stuff? He had to be facing that nonsense. But he had the courage. He had the heart at the time to go ahead and to open the doors for anybody who wanted to come in, who wanted to perform. So he started this little music deal, and he started recording artists or those who wanted to be artists. And one day in 1962, there was a group that was coming up from Macon, Georgia to Memphis, Tennessee that was going to perform, that was going to see what they could do to cut a record. And the artist's name was Johnny Jenkins. And he had a group, Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers. So because he didn't drive, he had his quote-unquote valet or one of his singers, because Johnny played the guitar. He was a Chuck Berry wannabe. You know, he was a guy who played the guitar and would be doing all these crazy things with the guitar and dancing around. So he had that flair. Not too much. He had the flair to kind of hide his limited ability to play the guitar, but people were just struck by the moves and the grooves of what he was doing while he was playing this guitar. Well, so he goes up to Macon, Georgia, and Johnny is a little bit scared to be driving, so he had his backup singer along with the rest of the Pine Toppers drive up to Memphis with him, and the singer got out of the car, the station wagon, in front of Stax Studio, and he was unloading the equipment and everything, and the guy who was unloading the equipment and making sure everything was all right and making sure that Johnny got to the appointment on time and making sure that he was ready to rumble and record this album or record this single for him, that roadie's name was Otis Redding. So the story goes is that they started recording Johnny Jenkins, and they did a few songs with them, and Jim Stewart, who was the overseer of the studio session that day, and the players or the musicians at that time, Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn and Louis Steinberg and Booker T. Jones and Al Jackson Jr., they were trying to make it work with Johnny, and this just wasn't happening. It just wasn't ready. And they were like, look, man, you know what? I gotta go. Really, like the musicians were getting antsy, and they were like, Jim, I gotta go. I mean, we ain't getting anything out of this guy. I'm playing at a gig tonight at the Plantation Inn, or they had different jobs. They had separate jobs when they weren't working at Stax. So they were like, Jim, I gotta go, man. I gotta get out of here. This is just a waste of time. Well, they were like, look, it's early. They booked the time. They booked the time for this amount of time, and we still have about 15, 20 minutes left to go. So, shit. You know what? There's this guy over here. The guy who was unpacking the equipment. Yeah. Well, he keeps saying that he's a singer. He's a singer. He's a singer. So, what do you want to do, man? All right. I mean, you know, we got to stay here. All right, motherfucker. Let's see what you got. So, that person was Otis Redding. Otis Redding had been bugging the drummer Al Jackson Jr. Hey, man, I can sing. I can sing all during the session with Johnny Jenkins. He was up there in Al Jackson's ear talking about, I can sing, I can sing, I can sing. I got this, I got these, I got this. And Al Jackson was just like, hey, man, would you just get this motherfucker on the mic because this guy is just bugging me. If this guy's talking about, like, to sing one more time, I'm going to take my snare and whack it over his head. So could you just please get this guy on the mic and get him out of my hair? And Steve Cropper was like, sure, man, no problem. So Otis came over and Steve was like, all right, let's go ahead and do this. So the first song that Otis recorded was something called Shout Bama Lama or something like that. And it was a takeoff of Little Richard. Otis was a huge Little Richard fan growing up. Little Richard being from Macon, Georgia. Otis Redding being from Macon, Georgia. Little Richard being the guy that kind of paved the way or kind of gave you the blueprint or kind of gave you the hope and aspirations that, hey, wait a minute. Even though I'm poor, even though I'm black, and even though I'm from Macon, Georgia, I do have this talent to sing and entertain. And if Little Richard can do it, and he can be a big star, why not I? So there was a lot of folks in that region who were Little Richard fans. So when Otis did a Little Richard number or something that he wrote that sounded like Little Richard, everybody in the studio was sitting there going, yeah, okay, man, this is some bullshit. This ain't, you know, this sounds like Little Richard. I really don't want to hear another Little Richard. The world doesn't want to hear another Little Richard. Can we go now, please, Jim? And Otis was like, hold on. I got one more song. All right. He's got one more song. Jesus. All right. What song is it? All right. What key do you want me to play it in? Well, don't worry about the key. Just play me them church chords. That's what Otis said. Just give me them church chords. All right. I'll give you the church chords. All right. Oh, and we're going in 3, 2, or in 1, 2, 3, or whatever. And this is the song that he came up with.
These arms are mine. They are lonely. Lonely and feeling blue. These arms.
There you go. And it was like, hey. Might have something here. Hold on for a second. This is not too bad. Now, legend has it that everybody, when he heard These Arms Are Mine, all of a sudden said, oh my God, this is a hit. And the hair stood up on my arms and everyone ran in and was like, this is unbelievable. Who is this guy? This is just that. That's the legend. The reality from the biographies and everything that I read about that fateful day when Otis was quote-unquote discovered, was that everybody was like, yeah, that's nice. I mean, that's something that we can put on the radio. But nobody was projecting that Otis' career would take off like it did. You got to remember, he was only doing this for 4 years. If you think about it, he was mainly discovered around 62, 63, and he died in 67. So we're speaking about a span of 4 years. The meteoric rise that Otis Redding had was pretty remarkable. But again, at that time, no one was sitting there going, wow, this is the guy that's going to become the king of soul. This was a guy who's going to be the leading man to take the place of what Sam Cooke was doing when he was murdered 3 years before. And I'll get to that a little bit later. So, it was something to where they made the record, These Arms Are Mine. His guy put the record out, gave it to disc jockeys, and they played it, and they played it, and they played it, and it steadily, slowly but surely started gaining a little bit more momentum. And during that time, Otis started recording other songs, and he started going out on the road, and he just kept grinding, and the music started getting better, and his songs started getting better, and he started to mature, and his And he just continued to grow, and he grew into the person that is a legendary figure. And again, it was all because of the relationship that he had in this segregated city known as Memphis, Tennessee. I guess back then it was a town known as Memphis, Tennessee. And where everything was segregated, these folks were able to work with each other. No color of stacks. Nobody was calling each other crackers or niggers or anything like that. It was absolutely unbelievably beautiful. It was a beautiful, beautiful situation. And you had the situation where living in that city, when they left Stax, when the musicians and Booker T. Jones and Al Jackson left Stax and went back to their neighborhoods because it was segregated. They lived in an all-black neighborhood. They were being called sellouts and how could you be working with Whitey and all these type of things. And when Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper went back to their neighborhood, which was all white, you have their friends and colleagues and neighbors calling them nigger lovers and how could you be hanging around those niggers, and they were being disgraced because of that. But because of the bond that they formed with each other, because of the genuine love that they had for each other, not just as musicians, but also as human beings, they didn't care. They absolutely didn't care. So the story of Otis Redding just needs to be told. I think it needs to be told. And you're speaking about a guy who, again, a guy who had the ability to, when he first started, he would go to the college fraternities that were all white and be able to integrate with them or be able to get them to love the music that they were putting down. And also he would go on the Chitlin Circuit and go to the Apollo and go to the Howard Theater and go to all of the black-owned nightclubs and theaters and play and be able to do that. So because of Otis Redding, because of the music, because of his personality, because of the impact of his personality and his music and his talent and his ability to be able to work with others, he was able to impact society like no other. Because when he came out with Fat, 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 Sad Songs, when he came out with Old Man Trouble, when he came out with Try a Little Tenderness, when he came out with Respect, when he came out with Day Tripper and Satisfaction, everybody loved it. Not just the black folks, the white folks loved it too, especially in England. So for me, Otis Redding is just, again, a guy for me, touches the heart just a lot. And love the guy, man. If I was, I could name almost all Otis Redding songs. I could sing almost all of Otis Redding songs, but when you think about it, well, I'm thinking about the five Otis Redding songs that I like the most. Number one would have to be, have you ever heard the alternate version of Day Tripper? Now, I'm thinking the first time they didn't use Day Tripper, because I have both the original and I also have the one that they put out on the record. The one that they put out on the record is a little bit more subdued. It's just a little bit more polished. I didn't like that one as much as I liked the alternative. If you could ever just Google or YouTube Day Tripper alternative Otis Redding and listen to that bad boy, that joint is funky as shit, especially when you're speaking about the last minute. A lot of times on my break music, I use that the last minute or so of that because it's just so doggone funky, man. It is just funky as shit. So Day Tripper, I love. These Arms of Mine, the greatest love song I think I've ever heard is up there. Respect, that what Aretha took, but Respect was one of my favorites from Otis. Chain Gang, a cover that he had from Sam Cooke, that was one of my favorites. Try a Little Tenderness. Al Bell, who worked at Stax during this time. Black man, again, integrated. He was one of the higher-ups in the Stax organization. But he told an interesting story. When Otis Redding recorded Try a Little Tenderness, and Try a Little Tenderness was something that was that had been around since the 1930s and such luminaries as Frank Sinatra and other white entertainers as such had recorded that song. Sam Cooke did it for the Copa. In his Live at the Copa album, he just did a verse or two of Try a Little Tenderness. But, you know, Bing Crosby's version and Frank Sinatra's version was very clean and very polished when you think about it. And the Otis Redding came in and he made it funky. He made it soulful. He made it gritty. He made it grimy. He made it Otis Redding style. when he recorded that song and he put it in the Otis Redding pocket, when he gave it the Otis Redding seasoning and flavor, the people who wrote the music, who wrote that song, tried to sue him. They tried to sue him because what they were saying was, this was just a little bit too much. You are bastardizing the song too much. You have taken it to a place where we didn't want it to go. You have taken this beautiful, polishing, lovable song and you throw dirt and grime and grit and nastiness on it. And that's the way it's going to, we don't want that to happen. Such ignorance, such foolishness, such stupidity. So Try a Little Tenderness from Otis is one of my favorites. Fast, 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 that song, one of my favorites. And of course, you know, Otis had written a track that he and Steve Cropper had written, something called Dock of the Bay. Now, Dock of the Bay, as you know, is his watershed, fantastic. This is what he's known for. If you're going to listen to an Otis Redding song, this is what they're going to be playing on the radio. This is what white folks and folks who might not know too much about Otis Redding, this is what they're going to be remembering. This is what they're going to be coming up with. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. My favorite version of Dock of the Bay was always the original version. It was always this one.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting in the evening sun, watching the ships roll in, then I'll watch them roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, and I headed for the Frisco Bay, 'cause I've got nothing to live for. Look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything seems to stay the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Sitting here resting my body.
You see, that's my favorite. That's the one that I like the most. It's not with the seagulls and not with the Cropper's licks or anything, but for me, that was my favorite. But the story of Otis on December 10th, 1967, the day before, he had been in Cleveland, Ohio, and he recorded a TV show. He was on a TV show where he sang with the Barcades, and he sang Try a Little Tenderness and Respect, which is like a television show. So that night he played at Leo's Casino in Cleveland. He played a couple of sets that night. And then that morning he was going to fly to Madison, Wisconsin to play at a place, the Factory in Madison, Wisconsin. So the weather was bad, especially in Madison. I believe the temperature was like around 30 or 40 degrees, somewhere around there, when they left for Cleveland. And the story goes, it was like, hey, look, people were like, hey, you know, Otis, maybe you should kind of delay this flight, or maybe you shouldn't take this gig because the weather in Madison was pretty bad. Now, at the time, Otis had just purchased his own aircraft, because, again, he was looking to get more off the road. He was getting tired after years and years and years of doing one-nighters, and the wear and tear on the road and everything. He was going to kind of cut that down, and one of the ways to make his trips a lot easier, and he could get back to Macon, or he could see his wife Zelma and his four kids, one of the things that he could do was get a jet or get a plane. And also, owning a plane at that time was a symbol of, wait, wow, we made it. And it was also speaking about Black power. You know, the ability at the time where we're speaking about the 60s here, especially in the South where Otis lived at the time. He lived in a big spread about 20 miles south of Macon, Georgia, in this place called Round Oak, Georgia. But he was a symbol in terms of, this is the Black man who has five Cadillacs, four Fords, three Lincolns, two, you know, all these types of things. This was a man who had business ventures. This was a man who had this big house. And this was a man who had these suits and these shoes and these wonderful outfits. And this was a man also in the music biz. Very few at that time had their own private plane. James Brown had a Learjet at the time, or a really nice plane, but Otis was one of the very few who could say that, you know what, I get to my gigs not by buses with 15 other acts. I get to my gigs by flying. But unfortunately, the plane that he bought was not of top quality, which is one of the things where it was kind of like, you know what, Otis, maybe you should go ahead and sit this bad boy out. But Otis saying was always going to make, I got to make that dollar. He never missed a gig. Didn't want to miss a gig. Got to make that dollar. So he went in that plane. And the flight from Cleveland to Madison was fine, but as they started to descend, or they started to, you know, start their descent into Madison, something on that plane went horribly wrong. They smashed right down into Lake Monona, and they all died except for Ben Colley. He was with the Barkees, and Otis, who was sitting in the front seat of the plane, when they found him the next day at the bottom of the lake, he was still strapped into his seat. There's conflicting reports about what happened in terms of, did he go down? Did he drown? Or when I say, did he drown? Was he coherent? Was he conscious when he went into the water? When they found his body, he had a big mark on his head. So the thought was, I hope this is the case, is the fact that when the plane hit the water, he was knocked unconscious and went down with the plane and drowned that way. There were other of the Barkees who were at the top of the water in this freezing water. You got to remember, this is December. So there were these guys who were trying their best to stay afloat and trying not to go under. And unfortunately, they went under. And the lone survivor, Ben Colley, said that, you know, that he heard his friends, he heard his bandmates screaming and yelling for help, and he just couldn't help them. And he was about to lose conscious, and he was about to go under, and he was like, well, this is it. And someone saved him. But unfortunately, they couldn't save the others. So really a bad thing. I was watching something about Otis a couple of days ago, and I just finished listening to another audiobook with Otis Redding, the latest audiobook or the latest book about the life of Otis Redding. So, you know, still a little fresh in terms of like, damn, man, that's just fucked up, man. That's just, I saw it sad the way to go, because he had so much more to offer. He had been to the Monterey Pop Festival and 7,500 white folks and flower children and up there in Monterey, California. And this was a little event where he crossed over. After years of being on the road, after years of playing on the Chitlin circuit, after years of really not having that major opportunity to really cross over to a whole new audience here in America. He did in England with white folks, but America, he was still relatively an anomaly, relatively not known amongst white folks. But when he went to Monterey and just blew them out of the fucking water in terms of the performance that he gave with Booker T and the MGs, the house band, and he played Shake, and he played Satisfaction, and he played Respect, and he played Loving You Too Long, and then he ended it with Try a Little Tenderness, in which the place was just going nuts when he finished. It was just going, in fact, don't listen to me, listen to this. We'll be right back. Yeah, that's what it was all about. It was all about Janis Joplin was in awe. Jimi Hendrix, who was there, was in awe. Everybody just lost their mind. And he called up Zelma from the road that night, and he says, I got him. Got myself a whole new audience. That was June of 1967, and less than 6 months later, he would be dead. So just when he was about to even further advance the society, even when he was about to even do more to help improve the society, this happened. So messed up, kind of messed up. But you know what? Hey, man, I guess when it's time to go, the Lord says, sorry, your work here is done. So, you know, that's the way it goes. But, man, you're talking about one of my heroes, just the story itself. I even wrote a song about that a long, long time ago. I wrote a poem about that a long, long time ago. I was trying to impress some girl, I don't know, about 27 years ago, probably like 25, 26, 27 years ago. Trying to impress this girl, so I wrote a poem where, you know, we fell in love and then I died in a plane crash. Incredibly, she didn't sleep with me. Could you imagine that? Wow, I mean, that didn't work. Ooh, she was, don't know what went wrong with that one, but yeah, so you're talking about a day where we should remember, a day to where we should be saying thank you, not only on September 9th, the date of his birth, speaking about Otis Redding, the date December 10th, today, December 10th, we should give just a little pause, just to give a little thank you to the great Otis Redding for the contributions and music and the improvement of society through his music and through his character and through his perseverance and through his generosity and through his belief in himself and others that helped make this world a much, much better place. Wendell's World in Sports. I'm your host, Wendell Wallace. Oh, doesn't that sound good? That sounds real good. That is the sound of the greatest singer in modern music history. When everybody wants to sit there, I've always said this, the greatest, it's no debate. There's no discussion. The greatest voices in contemporary music, probably from the 1960s on, and you can even go back even further if you want to. For males, the greatest singer of them all, I'm speaking about voice, is Sam Cooke. It's the person that we just listened to on the intro. It's Sam Cooke. The greatest female voice, without question, without debate, without argument, is Aretha Franklin. Without question. In fact, there's a stronger argument to be made about who was the greatest basketball player during the Michael Jordan era. Of course, everybody's going to say Michael Jordan. Of course, everybody's going to say he's the GOAT when it comes to basketball. Well, you can make an argument that you can say Bill Russell. You can make an argument to say Wilt Chamberlain. You can make an argument to say Oscar Robertson. You can make an argument to say LeBron James. You can make an argument on all those things. You might sit there and say no, 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 no. But I'm telling you, there's more competition for the debate who's the greatest basketball player of all time with Michael Jordan. There's a greater debate. There's a greater argument to be made on having other people say, having other people put those legendary basketball players ahead of Jordan. There's a bigger argument to be made for that than to say anybody else is a greater singer than Aretha Franklin or Sam Cooke. I don't give a fuck who you put out there. There is nobody, zero, with the voice of Sam Cooke. Nobody. And if you say anybody else, I'm sorry, in my opinion, you don't know jack shit about music and you need to get your ears checked. Or you need to check your taste in music because you are a clown and a fool if you think there's a better voice than the one we just heard. Listen to this again. You gonna put in there? Who else you want to say? Don't put in Nat King Cole, because Nat King Cole had nothing to do with soul and with R&B. Nat King Cole was great. Nat King Cole was awesome, but Nat King Cole wasn't around for the birth of soul and rhythm and blues, which was then stolen by white folks and turned into rock and roll. Don't say Elvis Presley. Don't say anybody else. The main guy, don't say anybody else. It's Sam Cooke. Sam Cooke, that's it. Don't say Marvin Gaye. Don't say Smokey Robinson. Don't say Luther Vandross. Don't say Eddie Lover. Don't. No. Zero. Stop. No. 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 You can ask any of those guys, and they would tell you, yeah, don't put me above Sam Cooke, because Sam Cooke, as far as a singer is concerned, is the greatest. Now, if you want to talk about who's a better entertainer, you can make an argument about that. If you want to talk about who is a better dancer or whatever, you can make an argument like that. Sam didn't have the raw ability to perform like a Michael Jackson or like a James Brown. He didn't have the musical genius of someone like a Ray Charles or a Prince or somebody like that. But just in terms of speaking about the voice, man, the voice, nobody touches Sam. No one comes close to Sam. No one in any way, shape, or form can deal with Sam in that way. And the artist that he inspired, the artist that idolized him, we're not just talking about Otis Redding. I'm not just talking about Aretha Franklin or a Marvin Gaye or a Stevie Wonder. I'm talking about people like the Beatles. I'm talking about people like the Rolling Stones. I'm talking about having on film Rod Stewart talking about, not only did I want to sound like Sam Cooke, shit, I wanted to be Sam Cooke. That's how powerful this man was when you're speaking about Sam Cooke. We're talking about the Beatles idolizing Sam Cooke. The Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger idolizing Sam Cooke. Tom Jones idolizing Sam Cooke. Al Green idolizing Sam Cooke. Smokey Robinson. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. During his musical career, speaking about Sam, 43 hits on the Billboard's top 10 charts over 10 years, from 1957 to 1966. 2 years after his death, he was still putting out, they were still putting out stuff about him. That was charting. 17 of those hits were in the top 20 of Billboard's pop charts. And Cooke wrote and co-wrote many of the hit songs. My favorites, the original version of Sugar Dumpling, Bringing On Home to Me, Having a Party, Change Is Gonna Come, of course, Win Your Love for Me, Just for Me. It was just a plethora. Chain Gang, I could go on. Rome Wasn't Built in the Day, Saturday Night. I could just go on and on and on and on and on, man. It was just amazing how much stuff this man put down.
Let me tell you about a place somewhere up in New York way, where the people are so gay, twisting the night away. Here they have a lot of fun, putting trouble on the run. Man, you find the hole in yon, twisting the night away. They're twisting, twisting. Everybody's feeling great. They're twisting, twisting.
Name somebody. Name somebody. Give me somebody for real. Can you really sit there and tell me? Well, I mean, that's cool and everything. He's got a nice voice and everything, but I mean, shit. I mean, is he Elvis Presley? I mean, give me a fucking break. So, I mean, you know, we're speaking about Sam Cooke. 1986, he was inducted as a charter member in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He was up there with James Brown and Little Richard and Fats Domino and Ray Charles and Chuck Berry and the Everly Brothers, really, and of course Elvis and Buddy Holly and Jerry Lee Lewis, Robert Johnson, Jimmy Rogers, Jim Yancey, all of these great, unbelievable performing artists. But, you know, Sam started his career not as a pop singer, but in the gospel profession. This is, again, where I'm talking about, kids, you need to sit here and learn this. High school juniors all across the country, you need to sit here and learn about this. Along with learning about the other things that happened in this earth and happening on this in this country to get to where we are today. This is something that you need to learn. Sam started out his career not singing popular music, but he started singing gospel, and he was with the Soul Stirrers. And he replaced this guy named R.H. Harris. R.H. Harris was a guy who was the lead singer for the Soul Stirrers at a time when, in the black community, gospel groups were the end-all, the be-all back in those days. And the Soul Stirrers were the superstars. And R.H. Harris was like the Michael Jackson of the Jackson 5, so to speak. But R.H. decided to leave the group, or quote-unquote retire, because he didn't like the avenue that gospel music was taken. Now, of course, there were rumors saying that RH also wanted to get out and lay low for a while because he had fathered several children by several different women, and they were coming after him for money. And that's the real reason why RH Harris left the Soul Stirrers. But be that as it may, so when this group, who at the time was the number one gospel group in the United States, which means that basically they were the superstars as far as entertainers are concerned, as far as musicians are concerned in the black community, that when they were looking for someone to replace this idol, this superstar, they came up with Sam Cooke, who at the time I believe was like 19 or 20 years old, a very, very young guy. So Sam came in and everyone was like, well, you know, how's this motherfucker going to do? Here's RH with the man, RH with the greatest, RH with the goat. Now you're going to be replacing him with this little kid right here. What exactly is he going to do? Well, Sam came up with a song called Jesus Gave Me Water. And he came up with it in 1951. And it sounded something like this.
Oh, Jesus gave me water. Jesus gave me water. Jesus gave me water. I want to let his praises swell. Jesus gave me water. Jesus gave me water. Jesus gave me water. And it was not well. There was a woman from Samaria came to the well to get some water. There she met a stranger who did a story tell. That a woman dropped a pitcher, she drank and was made richer from the water.
So when Sam came up with that, it was the biggest selling single that the Soul Stirrers had ever had. You got it. Proof positive. You got it. We're convinced. We bow down. You the man. We're going to be fine. So that was the song that Sam Cooke wrote for the group. It was the biggest single that they've ever had, and Sam was definitely on his way. And of course, with his good looks, he would go up on stage, and this was a guy who would bring the element. Before, when we think about the gospel singers, when we speak about the audience that the gospel singers attracted back in those days, you know, you would think about middle age and that type of thing. Well, Sam brought out the younger crowd to the church, and he mainly brought out the girls to the church to go watch him perform, to go watch him sing. And, you know, you're going into a house of worship back then, and you have these girls up there swooning and yelling and screaming, and, oh, Sam, 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 you know, hold me, Sam, oh, you know, you can bring me water, Sam, woo. I mean, these girls are up here turning it out, and all of a sudden now this guy is up here in front of this, in this church, Sam's up here in front of this church, and he's kind of egging them on, you know, he's kind of got the, whoa, whoa, whoa. I mean, you know, you can tell that he's singing. And these old ladies and these old men and all these folks are looking at him like, what the fuck is he? I don't think they were saying what the fuck in church. But they were like, what in the Lord's name is he doing up here trying to, you know, seduce these girls and, you know, get the devil in them and all this kind of stuff. So you know, it was kind of like a battle almost, because you would have these girls who would be getting spankings in church because of the way that they were reacting when Sam would come out on stage, and Sam would be up there, according to Bobby Womack, he would be up there with a mirror in front of him, and he would be combing his hair while he was singing, and these church folks are like, what's going on here, man? What's happening to our sanctified, this, that, and the other? This ain't anything like that, but so Sam was the guy to bring out the younger generation, and now he was the man. So basically, where he turned it up a notch, and while this is where he really took a turn for the better for society, was he said, look, I can't do this forever. I mean, with the gospel singers, he's up there on the Chitlin circuit and he's going up and down and this, that, and the other. He said to himself, look, man, I can't do this anymore. I want to try secular music. I want to try pop music. I want to try to go out there and do what Ray Charles is doing. I want to go out there and go out there and just start singing secular music. And people were like, Sam, are you crazy? Are you nuts? You can't do that, man. Man, you can't. You're a gospel singer. You're the number one gospel singer. You got your audience. You're making a good living. You're doing all these great things. You don't need to go secular, man. You realize that if you go secular, you're going to lose your entire audience. Not only are you going to lose your entire audience, you'll be singing the devil's music, man. You know what happens when you sing the devil music? You're going to lose your soul like that? Nah. And if you bomb, because remember, this ain't the 2019, this ain't the 2009s, this ain't the 1995, this ain't the 1985s, this is the 1950s. This is the late 1950s and early 1960s, man. We're talking about a situation where it's like, Sam, if you leave the gospel, if you leave the gospel field and you go to the pop field and start singing secular music, A, you might not make it. There's a good chance you might not make it, because how many people that look like us with our skin color is going to go out there and be successful? Hardly any. So you're going to be out there. Your chances of not making it are good. And it ain't, and this is not a situation where, oh, shit, I bombed out there in a pop. Let me go back to gospel. No, man. Once you leave gospel, that door is shut, it's locked, it's bolted, and you ain't getting in no matter how hard you try, no matter how hard you bang, no matter what object you try to knock that door down, you are not getting back in if you leave gospel to sing secular music. And that's the easiest thing for you to deal with. That's going to be the least of your problems. What in the world is the Lord going to do when he sees you singing gospel, when he sees you taking his songs and putting them into pop music? The Lord ain't gonna like that. But Sam was like, I gotta give it a try. I gotta do this. I absolutely have to do this. So he came out with his first record, and he had it under Dale Cook. And people were like, shit, come on, man. Dale Cook, get the hell out of here. I know that voice. You damn Sam Cook. What, you nuts? Well, you know, he went ahead and he forced anyway. Came out with a song called You Send Me, You Send Me. And you know what? I'm doing an injustice. Hold on for a second. Sam, how does it sound?
Darling, you send me. I know you send me. Darling, you send me. Honest you do, honest you do, honest you do.
So he put that song out. It sold like close to, I know it went gold, but it became the number one song in the country. It became the number one song on the pop charts. It replaced Elvis, and the rest, as we say, was history. Especially when we're talking about, damn, you know what? Everybody from Otis Redding to Sam and Dave to Marvin Gaye to Smokey Robinson to all these black singers who grew up in the church, all of a sudden now, they see this guy out there singing pop music and they see that, wait a minute, the heavens didn't open up and lightning didn't strike them. Wait a minute, a hand didn't come down from God and take them and destroy them. Wait a minute here, we can actually go ahead and start singing pop tunes and we can make money. We can make fame, and we can still live a righteous life in terms of not having to worry about, you know, any supernatural demise happening to us. This is awesome. This is fantastic. So that's what Sam Cooke did. Sam Cooke allowed the music. Sam Cooke really was Motown before Motown. In 1961, he started his own record label, Sar Records, with J.W. Alexander and his manager, Roy Crane. And he brought in the Valentinos, he brought in Bobby Womack, he brought in Johnny Taylor. He created a publishing imprint and management firm. He named it Kags. So this was back in the days when, you know, singers, especially black singers, man, they ain't going to be up there talking about owning the rights to your music, owning the rights to your song. No. Now you're starting about talking about opening up or doing a record label? No. Hold on for a second. You know, but back then, and even now, record companies were owned by white folks. You know, and all of a sudden now, I mean, the white folks would use and abuse and cheat and demoralize and steal from black folks left and right. I mean, they would sit there and take their shit, and they would steal their music and give it to somebody else and take all their money, and, you know, these black folks would be broke. They would be the ones writing the music. They would be the ones making the hits, and all they would have to show for it would be a fancy watch and a car. Meanwhile, the royalties and everything else went to the white managers or went to the white record labels or went to the white producers. None of the money was going to the black folks. None of the money was going to the black talent that was making the music. And Sam was like, no. Now, I'm going to change that right now. I'm not going to be taken advantage of like that. So because of his talent, he had the ability to go ahead again and start having the money come to him when he wrote the songs. Oh, and guess what? Because his songs were so great, when people like the Rolling Stones and some other white folks and the British and the Beatles and the other British bands started covering their songs, guess who was getting a portion of that money from their sales? Yeah, it was Sam Cooke and those who made the music from his SAR Records label. So, yeah, man, Sam was something else. So he was huge. He was big. The night he was killed, one of the stories that just make me say, wow, unfucking believable, man. The death of his son really spun him for a loop. His son, Vincent. I think he had two or three kids. Well, he had a lot more than two or three kids, but he took care of two or three kids. He was a womanizer. He was always a womanizer. You know, back then, you know, you'd have a kid and go ahead and you would say, I'm going to go ahead with my career and I really don't have the time to be a husband and a father. So Sam was married twice. His first wife was killed in a car accident. I think that he fathered a couple of kids out of wedlock, didn't take care of them because he was going ahead with his singing career. But he married someone named Barbara, and they moved out to Los Angeles once Sam really became an international superstar, when he became a star. And he bought a house out there in a really nice neighborhood, and he had a pool. And his son, who was an infant at the time, he was at work. And his wife, the mother of the child, left the infant near the swimming pool. And then she left him unattended to go back into the house. Now, why in the name of fuck would you do something that irresponsible and that fucking stupid? Lord only knows. But, of course, she leaves this infant by a pool, goes back into the house, and, oh, when she comes back out, guess where the baby is? Drowned in the pool. So, of course, Sam was just, you know, devastated beyond belief. Blamed Barbara for it, which I don't blame him. And, of course, the marriage after that really disintegrated. What disintegrating? And some of Sam's vices, such as womanizing and getting out of the house, and he really didn't want to be around her. And, of course, if you're still in the house where your son, your infant son died, and you have to walk past that pool every day and see this is where your son died, I can understand where, you know what, I really don't want to be in this house, or I really don't want to spend too much time in this house, especially when I'm still building my career, and I'm living with someone who I think is responsible for my son's death. So all of those things played into a part on the night of December 10th, 1964. He was with some friends over at some bar, and he met this hooker, who he didn't know was a hooker, I guess, but he met this girl named Elisa Boyer, who was half Asian and half something else, or some Asian and some something else. Well, they were sitting together and they were talking, and at that time, during that night at the club where Boyer was, he was flashing around a lot of money. You know, he was kind of showing folks, you know, that he had a big wad of money. So this is my theory. This is my guess, is that Boyer saw this, or she was hip to it, and then Sam started talking to her, and she started talking to him, and I guess she saw that he was a little bit drunk, so she thought, easy target. So what happens was, is that the two left together, and they got into Sam's Ferrari, and they drove down to a hotel, a $3 a night hotel in East LA on Figueroa Street. Of course, Sam being married, don't think the man's going to be taking this hooker who he's going to want to bang back to his wife's house, back to the house where his wife and his kids are. So he needed to find somewhere where he could go ahead and do a thing and wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, and get this over, get this done with. So he went down to Figueroa Street, $3 hotel, checked in. Her and the prostitute. He signed the name Mr. and Mrs. Sam Cook. Got the keys to the place. Went into the room. He took off his clothes. Before he was going to get ready to be knocking them boots, he went into the bathroom. Well, while in the bathroom, the prostitute took his clothes and everything and left. So basically, she robbed him. This is my theory of what happened, okay? This is, in a second, you'll hear something different, but this is my theory of what happens. That it was consensual, that yes, hey, let's go to this place, you know, let's get a little bit more friendlier. Sam took his clothes off. She saw that this was her opportunity to go ahead and rob him. So she went ahead and robbed him. So she took her clothes, took his clothes, and she bolted. Well, Sam comes out of the bathroom. He's butt naked. He sees that his clothes are gone. He sees that the woman is gone. He realizes, he puts two and two together. He realizes that, oh shit, I've been robbed. Well, drunk, irate. How can someone do this to me, the great Sam Cook? How can this worthless whore bitch do this to me, Sam Cook? She's nothing but a $20 a night hooker. And I'm the great international star, Sam Cook. How could she do this to me? That bitch ain't going to get the best of me. I'm drunk, I'm angry, and I'm irrational. And did I mention that I was drunk? So, puts on a sport coat, puts on, I think, just his shoes, and that's it. Man's running out butt bald naked. Runs to the manager's room. Bertha Franklin. Knocks on the door. Hey, come on, let's go. Hey, where's the girl? Now, Bertha was on the phone. And she was like, man, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. The girl ain't here. He breaks in. He's looking around. Where's the girl? She's like, look, man, I don't know what you're talking about. So this 55-year-old woman who's outweighs Sam by about 30 pounds, Bertha Franklin and Sam Cook, they get into a wrestling match. They get into a... So she's fighting and she's scratching and she's kicking and she's clawing because Sam is saying, where's the girl? You know, he's pretty pissed off. So she takes a gun, shoots the man twice. The last thing that he says on this planet is, lady, you shot me. Makes one more leap at her. She hits him over the head with a broomstick, and that's it. And then he's dead. And that's how the great international star, Sam Cook, on the morning of December 11th, dies at a $3 hotel in Figueroa, as he was out there trying to get it on with some hooker. Now, the story that was told in court was, well, this was from Elisa Boyer. In fact, this is what she said in her testimony.
He latched the night latch on, and he says, well, we're just going to talk. I didn't have nothing to say except that I wanted to go home, so we didn't have anything to talk about.
Bullshit. Absolute bullshit. How in the hell, if he's going to pin you down and she's yelling, take me home, and he's like, oh, baby, we're just going to talk. If he really did all those things, if he really intended to rape you, why the fuck would he leave you sitting there on the bed while he took his clothes off and then went into the bathroom? Sam Cook was a stupid bitch. Come on now. I mean, that's ridiculous. Here, I'm going to rape you, but before I rape you, let me go ahead and leave you here while I go use the bathroom and close the door. Yeah, that's something I'm going to do. Absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. So, you know, and this is the testimony that Bertha Franklin gave in terms of the last moments in the life of Sam Cook.
And how far was Mr. Cook away from you when you started shooting?
He wasn't too far. He's at close range.
And how many times did you fire this pistol?
Three times.
And do you know whether you struck, or did you know you struck Mr. Cook?
Yes, because he said, lady, you shot me.
Man, that pisses me off. Yeah, fucking bitch. That pisses me off. It's just the way that the man went out, just... I mean, he was right on the cusp, man. I mean, he was... he was right there. We're talking about Sam. He was ready to make that next leap. He was out there learning from Malcolm X. He was out there, you know, hot-knobbing with Muhammad Ali, who was a huge fan of Sam Cooke. And we're talking about, and they were talking about Black Power, man. Back in the 60s, that's what it was all about. You had someone like Malcolm X who scared the shit out of white folks with what the stuff that he was saying, his intelligence. You were talking about Muhammad Ali, who then at the time was brash and braggadocious, and now all of a sudden, he's going to be siding with the Muslim. He's going to be having some type of connection to the Muslims. That scared white America. And now that you have Sam Cooke, now hobnobbing, knowing, hanging out with these guys, you think those at the record company, you think those who have invested interest in how much money Sam Cooke can make, you think that those guys are happy about the fact that he's hanging out with what they would think is being a black separatist and this loudmouth boxer who's going to be joining a hate group like the Nation of Islam who calls white people devils? You think that the music industry, you think they're happy that Sam Cooke is hanging out with people like that? You think that all of a sudden now Sam Cooke, because of his relationship that he had with Malcolm X, all of a sudden said, wait a minute, you know what, man? Singing about having a party and singing about Sweet 16 and singing about good times and everything. Meanwhile, my people are getting bitten and getting hosed on down in Alabama or are being abused or being lynched or being treated like second-class citizens. I'm listening to the teachings of Malcolm X. I'm listening to the teachings of, at that time, Elijah Poole, who went by the name Elijah Muhammad. I call him Elijah Poole because that's the con man was. But the message that he was given about black power, about black uniting, it's about black entrepreneurship and everything. You think that didn't scare white folks to death? Of course it did. And that all set up conspiracy theories about what happened the night he was killed. And when he made that song, Change Is Gonna Come. Man, powerful stuff, man. Change Is Gonna Come. It's just, listen, it's just powerful, powerful stuff. Listen to this. So yeah, that became one of the symbols of the civil rights movement moving forward. I mean, we're speaking about Sam Cooke, we're speaking about Otis Redding having relationships with Dr. King, Martin Luther King, and all these folks. Powerful, powerful stuff, man. But just getting back to Sam Cooke, I mean, just the way that he died that night. I mean, he had everything. He was about ready to take that next step forward. And Otis, poor judgment in terms of, you know, what could have been, should have been, would have been. But, I mean, the plane crash is the plane crash. You know, plane crash, he's not the first or the last artist to die in a plane crash. Patti Page or what's the woman's name? I'm Falling to Pieces. Patti Page, I think, saying that, or somebody, she died in a plane crash. Jim Croce died in a plane crash. Rocky Marciano died in a plane crash. A lot of people, folks, John Denver, Aaliyah, I mean, he wasn't the first or the last to die in a plane crash, speaking about Otis Redding, so it's kind of like, shit, that's the way it goes, but damn, man, to have Sam Cooke die the way that he did, So like I was saying, when he finally got, when I finally get to heaven or whatever, it's just Sam, baby Bubba, what happened? But those things need to be talked about in the schools, man. Those things need to be discussed because, again, without Sam Cooke being an inspiration, not just for black folks, but also for just folks in general, and just bringing a whole new level of understanding, a whole new level of what black folks go through, about a whole new level of different races and different communities starting to build relationships to where, while we still have a long way to go now, we're a lot better than we were 50 years ago, or we're a lot better than we were 20 years ago. We're not close to where we thought we were, or some folks thought we were, and we still have a long way to go despite what people might say. And even in this country that we are living in right now, where it's divided, where it's just overwhelmed with ignorance, overwhelmed with misinformation, we have a piece of garbage who right now is in the White House, and people who are stupid enough to believe that this is a man that should be given another 4 years, which shows that our lack of education, shows that our lack of common sense, shows that our lack of everything in terms of where we're going in the future, what our future even entails, the enormity of what could happen if a certain person gets another 4 years. It could be, despite all of those things, despite all of the the things that just make you shake your head about, have we taken a step forward? Have we taken a step back? Where are we in this country in terms of a lot of things? Hey, man, if it wasn't for Sam Cooke, if it wasn't for Otis Redding, we would be a lot worse. Race relations, black folks, Asian folks, Hispanic folks, gay folks, transgender folks, atheist folks, everybody, women, we would be in a lot worse situation than we are today because of the lack of understanding that we would have for each other, the boundaries, the stereotypes that would still be ingrained if it wasn't for folks like Sam and Otis to break those things down, to introduce ourselves in a different light. It would have been a whole lot different. It would have been a whole lot different. So again, I always think on this day, December 10th, baby, we need to go ahead and we need to say thank you. We need to say thank you very, very much. And not just December 10th, but also when it comes to Medgar Evers and Malcolm X. And of course, we have a national holiday for Martin Luther King, damn right. But also just others. Others that might have slipped through the cracks. Others to where we sit and we say, well, wait a minute, man. How is Jackie Robinson? How is Bill Russell? How is James Brown or Jim Brown? How is Jesse Owens? How is Joe Lewis? Why do we need to put them on the same page? Or why do we need to discuss these matters with them like we do with George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or presidents or people of politics or something like that? I think the more education we get, and the reason why we need to explain why these sports figures, why someone like a Sidney Poitier needs to be spoken of as a historical figure for what he's done for this country, for the advancement and the improvement of this country. Yeah, there wouldn't be a Barack Obama if it wasn't for people like Sam Cooke and Otis Redding and Ray Charles and Jackie Robinson and Joe Lewis and Bill Russell and Jim Brown and Oscar Robertson and such. There wouldn't be a Barack Obama or those type of black historical figures that we speak about now on the everyday. So as I end, because I've said all that I've had to say, and I want to thank you very much for listening. Don't worry. This is something that's very, very, I'm not going to do this hardly ever, but for a situation like this, when we talk about my heroes, whether it be Otis or Sam or Malcolm or Len Bias, or you know, I'm going to take some time to, every once in a while, every blue moon, very, 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 very rarely, I'm going to stray away from talking about sports to just let you know and how I feel about certain situations and how I feel about certain things. Again, this is all an opportunity to allow me to introduce myself to you and let you get an idea of what I'm all about, because I'm a lot more of a person than just talking about who's winning basketball games or how great the Georgetown Hoyas are or what I think about the Dallas Cowboys or getting off the bandwagon of the New England Patriots or who was my favorite, and who's the better basketball player, Michael Jordan or LeBron James or any of that stuff. Or I'm just going to let you know that I'm a little bit more of a complete human being than that. So I want to thank you very much. My name is Wendell Wallace. You have been listening to Wendell's World of Sports. Next time, we're going to talk about my Georgetown Hoyas. I'll leave you with that. Music!